There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Breathing is good, especially those big, full, deep breaths. Yes. All right. Welcome to the Tara Stiles Podcast. I'm Tara Stiles. Today, I'm excited to interview a new friend, Megan Reardon Jarvis. She's the author of a memoir called The End of the Hour, and she's also a trauma-informed psychotherapist with decades of experience. She also went to high school with Mike, so I'm excited to ask her about that experience, if her and Mike hung out or swapped stories. I'm listening to her book. She narrates it as well in the audiobook, so it's a great listen if you like audiobooks. And she shares along with Mike's perspective of really loving the escape of boarding school. So it's an experience I did not have. So I'm excited to dig into that. And her book is about her own story of grief, of trauma, of getting into the career of a therapist to help other people with their grief and trauma. And then her own grief and trauma kind of in a way sneaking up on her later in life and how she is dealing with that and has dealt with that. So lots to learn from this lovely, incredible woman and lots of wisdom to share. I'm hoping to get some little free therapy tips for all of us as well to help us work through our own grief and trauma. And also so many of us are in a position of listening, whether it's as a friend or as a yoga teacher or as just a human from person to person, helping each other through the very normal grief and trauma of life. So very excited to chat with her. And before we begin this chat, I'd love to lead us in a nice, simple meditation to notice how we feel, which is really the foundation for healing in a practice, not just to breeze over your own experience and to do the practice, but while you're doing your meditation, while you're doing your yoga, while you're doing your contemplation, to notice what's happening with you. Something, I don't know if we'll get to this interview, but Megan mentioned in her book that I thought was really profound and really honest was how she dealt with kind of erasing her feelings in a way when she was a small child. And she found her way to sneaking food, to binge eating. I think she even said specifically the combination of carbs and sugar. So bread and cookies and chips, and she would eat them really fast. And she noticed how that would really suppress her feelings. So for anyone, I think so many people, it's just a human experience again to have an imbalance relationship with food or really see food as a way to suppress feeling, whether you're consuming large amounts in this binging way or rejecting food as well. It's sort of the same thing. So much to unpack there as well. Hopefully I'll get into that with her too. So let's have a nice meditation where we notice how we feel so we can listen and be kind to ourselves. All right, finding an easy, centered place. Let your whole self soften a bit, a little bend in your bendable parts. This shows you to yourself that you're safe, that things are okay right now in this moment. And when you show yourself that things are okay, your body, your mind, all of the things that make up you say, all right, I can come out a little bit. I can peek out through the corner and say, this is what's going on. This is how I'm feeling. And simply listen here. Listen to what comes up with you. Notice any sensations physically, maybe in your center, in your mind, in your muscles, wherever you notice any sensation, simply listen to yourself, listen to those sensations. Notice any sensations as they come and even as they go. You don't need to try to fix anything right now. Simply listen like you would a small child that you care about or a friend. Listen to what those feelings, what those sensations are trying to tell you. What's underneath the sensation? What's going on? Give yourself this space, this time to simply be with yourself in this loving, this kind, this nurturing way, you caring for you. Simply notice how you feel. Take a big inhale. Long exhale. Nice. And let that go. So know that whenever you feel the call, the desire to get more connected with yourself, or whenever you feel out of sorts, anxious, you can have this safe space right with yourself, right with a few breaths together. And when you do a practice like this, those spaces start to grow and expand and become more of how you can experience all of the other moments. So I'm excited to get into this with Megan. See you on the other side. I'm listening to your book, by the way. I love that you I love that you talked through it. It's so good.
I really dreaded, I dreaded that because part of my process for writing the book was reading it out loud to myself. Oh, wow. I think that's a lot of people's process.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh my God, it's so tedious to read it out loud. But when I read it out loud with an audience in mind, it was completely different.
Oh, cool.
And like, and I was moved by things that I hadn't noticed or hadn't let myself be like emotionally connected to in a long time. Like,
oh, cool.
A writer.
Yeah, no, it's great. I love listening to you tell it because I met you and I'm like, ooh,
right?
It feels really good.
I know her.
Great. I know her. This person in my phone. Yes.
And I write a little bit about Exeter in there, not too much, but a little. Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. And also just for our yoga community, this is trauma is the biggest reason everybody gets into yoga, but often, like you say, it's the reason that we're not sort of like top of mind of. So people love it.
Well, it's interesting because when I reached out to you and then you sent me the links, I was like, oh, she does all this. Like you do all this. I was like, she doesn't need me to talk to her community about this, but there are so many things out there where it's like people are talking about trauma without maybe calling it trauma, right?
Yeah.
Like the first time I took a yin yoga class, nobody said anything about trauma, but I was like, why am I crying? Like, why does this hurt so much? Then why does it feel almost like an orgasm? And why am I crying? Like I've done a lot of yoga. What is happening? And since I've done so much somatic work and kind of like, I'm really trying to commit to this in the morning, doing a lot of like hip openers and all the things that really are like really connected to where you hold trauma in the hips. I just talk more about it. And there are people who are like, yeah, I know that. And then there are other like, yeah, I know that. I know that. I already knew that. And I'm like, really? How did I not know it? Well, and then there are other people. Go ahead.
Oh, no. But you're right. Like with yoga, because yoga, and you know this too, like can be so tense and rigid and like it can be trauma like inducing. And it can also be 100%. The best thing for, you know, working through it. And we get a lot of people that have come from
bad yoga experiences.
Yes. And then yes. But also on top of that, like coming to yoga because of their trauma.
Totally.
Subconsciously, and then having, you know, a manipulated experience, and then finding, well, yoga's awesome. Like, how can we do right. it in a way where it actually helps? So
I worked for a little while when I was at Children's Hospital. I worked on the eating disorder clinic with teenagers. And it was fascinating to feel the energy of people who could not be inside their bodies. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot about that, you know, for some, I'm writing this clinical book right now, which is just basically the tenet behind it is like, I am going to, as a coach does, encourage you to experiment with everything anyone has ever told me helps them with their grief. Mm. Some of these things that I say are going to be very wrong for you. Mm. And one of the things I'm always interested about is like, I would say 50% of my clients find sitting still on a mat, mm-hmm. impossible, mm-hmm. like untenable, not to be born in the early parts of their grief. Mm. And I have to remind them maybe a year in that they are not energetically in the same body in the same way. And wow. so that, you know, we always want to be able to figure out how to invite stillness. Mm-hmm. And just because it made you feel like a caged animal. And then for the other 50%, sitting in stillness is like going to church. It's like coming home. Mm. It's like finally giving them a pause to just sit with their feelings. Mm. And so it's really interesting. You know, there is no such thing as like one universal truth. Yeah. But I do think you know, there's a lot of controversy about this sort of in the grief community, but like, I do think you have to be able to feel your feelings.
Yeah.
And I do think you have to be able to figure out how to be still.
Yeah.
In order to do it.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, what I always loved about, and it's funny with like Mike too, because I came into yoga with like a good yoga experience and I found all the bad ones and I was really young, but then I was like, but yoga's great when you listen to how you feel.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then like you when you do yoga. And then Mike's like, Tara, that's Tai Chi. And I'm like, what do you mean it's Tai Chi? And he's like, it's Tai Chi. And then like the more other people that were like good at something were like, yeah, that's, you got to feel your feelings. It's like Tai Chi, it's Shiatsu, it's what you do.
Right. It's Rolfing, it's EMDR. But I do think, I mean, one of the big points I make in this clinical book, I'm talking about it because like it's due tomorrow and it's never going to be done in time. But a lot of the sentence I use a lot is that we grieve with our bodies. Mm. You know, that's, people talk about how we can't teach grief. And I get that because it's a really personal experience. It's probably the same way we can't teach sex. Mm. But we do those things with our bodies, and bodies are generalizable even across cultures.
Yeah.
Like they have 12 systems that, you know, the lungs are hooked up to the heart in the same way in most bodies. So we can't, I can't teach you what to do, but I can teach you what's happening inside your body. And then you can find your way forward in an educated way.
Wow.
So that's sort of the premise of this book. And I think one of the gentle, and I think a lot about this from what your yoga, because I think a lot about like my experience with yoga at Kripalu for the very first time, which was very gentle. It was incredibly gentle. It was the first class that I had been in where I didn't feel like other people were looking to see whether or not I could like do an inversion.
Right.
Right. And that it just is very opening, but I think the thing that is scary is that you are transformed by these experiences. Like you're transformed by grief. You're transformed by being in your body. Mm-hmm. And I think the energy can be really scary. So I'm always asking people to figure out how to titrate into it. Like, can you just feel like 2% more or 5% more, which is so similar to yoga.
Yeah.
Right. Yoga is about like, can you reach 1% more? Just see if your body will allow, if not, bend your knees. It's fine. Mm. It's just establishing trust.
Oh, you're a great yoga guide. I love it.
Right? I mean, I love yoga. I love yoga. And I hate yoga because I was not born super flexible. Like my hamstrings, even in my most flexible, I have always been like, why? Why can't you just give me a little bit more? And I have a very somatic body. So, you know, I throw my back out under times of stress. And so the idea that you can create a generalized practice that's for all the time.
Right.
That allows you to sit with your energy, which is really how I think about yoga.
Yeah.
And I just think people are often doing trauma work in yoga without knowing it. And there aren't that many things out there where that's the case, where you are doing a bottom-up approach to something without necessarily understanding any of the emotional component to it. Like you get the benefits of it, of doing the work without really having to have the insight, which is kind of cool, I think.
Yeah. I always love that about yoga. I remember doing it and feeling that. And also when I started leading it, people would come up to me and tell me, oh my gosh, like I got this great job, or I broke up with this abusive person and this happened. And I'm like, cool.
Right.
Like awesome.
That sounds excellent. Yeah. Yeah.
But like, again, not needing to, you know, become like someone like you who's gone through all of the degrees and all the experience, and they can talk about it with their therapist, but they can also come to yoga and just have it happen. And we like high five about it.
Well, it's the many pathways, right? Mm. Like I am deeply suspicious of anyone who's like, you need to sign on, drink the Kool-Aid. You have to do. I mean, I remember the first time I went into Bikram yoga, which I always loved Bikram. I love the heat. I love the like squishing of my gallbladder and all the stuff. But when I got into the locker room, people were like, you have to come every day or it doesn't work. And I was like, what are you talking about? I have 3 children. I cannot come to yoga 90 minutes every day. And I'm also pretty sure it's already working. Like, what are you talking about? And I think it's true in trauma work where people are like, no, you have to do this and you have to try all these things and or you're not doing it right. And I am so against that. I am very much like, trust the wisdom, anything that you're willing to try, analyze the data. Keep going.
So right? Good.
Right?
Right. Oh my gosh. Well, this book, you know, I want to, there's so many questions I want to ask you about this book, but, you know, just kind of hearing bits and pieces of your life along the way, one of the questions that comes up, and it's so relatable. I mean, everybody's life is so different, but this is probably like a duh for you, but is everybody traumatized? Is everybody grieving? These are just, it just seems like, you know, through your story, I can point to myself and I can point to my friends and relate, even though there's so many different things. But is that part of the sharing of your reason for?
That's not a duh question at all. Okay. I think that's an incredibly wise place to start, because I think the word trauma is in and of itself kind of confusing. Mm. And also we throw it around like it's, you know, like we do depression and, you know, I'm depressed, my football team lost. So I'll answer it in two pieces because grief is just the energetic response to loss. So you can actually grieve that your football team lost. that grief is not, it doesn't have to be that someone died. I think lots of people don't really sort of sit and look at the human experience of grief until it's really profound. Mm. But many of us are grieving, you know, people grieve not getting a job or, you know, not making it to their spot in time, or that it rained on their wedding day. I mean, those, you have expectations and hopes for yourself that don't materialize, and that is a loss. Mm. So it doesn't just have to be a death, and grief is just a natural experience. I think a lot about little kids. You know, when you see a little kid who's like, I wanted to go to the zoo, and they're like hysterical, and you're like, but it's a hurricane outside. You know, they don't care about the hurricane. They had a hope and a dream for themselves, and they are all the way brokenhearted, like all the way to the end. And I have to tell you, like, part of the reason I used to work a lot with little kids, and I just like loved their full on commitment, unfiltered commitment to their heartbreak. Mm. Right. So grief is a daily experience. And I actually encourage my clients who are working with me for profound loss to also identify the little losses, because our brain does this extraordinary thing where it kind of color codes our experiences for the purpose of learning. So it's collecting the material. So it's like, oh, good experience, bad experience, because it wants to help you avoid bad experiences. The one thing that's really typical for people who are grieving a really profound loss is that what they're feeling right now in the moment is sort of stitched to previous experiences. So I'll give you an example. My boss, when I moved down to DC, I worked at a think tank, and my boss died unexpectedly. He had cancer, but he wasn't expected to die, and he died. And I was sort of like beside myself, even though I didn't even really like him that much. And a lot of what was happening was I was remembering something I write about in the book, my grandfather dying. So when my grandfather died, I then immediately I left his funeral and went to boarding school. So there wasn't, nobody at boarding school knew I was coming from a funeral. I was like a little late getting there, but nobody really cared either. So there was no more processing of my grandfather dying. So when my boss died, who was also an elderly man, suddenly I was thinking a lot about my grandfather. And that's because the way the brain codes information, it sort of like sticks it in a file folder all together, and you pull out one page, but you might get a couple of the other pages, which is really interesting in terms of the brain. But let me say a thing about trauma. So trauma is just a bad thing that happens. COVID was a trauma for the entire globe. But for some people, being allowed to stay in their house and circle in and put make their footprint smaller was the best thing that's ever happened to them in their lives. So traumatized means the reaction to the trauma, the bad thing that happens, is negative, and that it lands inside your system and that you walk away from the event somehow less than. So traumatized is the meaning that you make of the event or the thing that happened. So many of us will be in a trauma, right? So there's a sort of, there's a famous example that Bessel van der Kolk has in his book of two people that he works with get into a terrible car accident on the way to see him. One never wants to get in a car again and becomes almost like agoraphobic. The other sort of tells it as a funny cocktail story. They were both in the trauma. Only one person becomes traumatized. And so a lot of what I write about in the book is sort of trying to help people understand, why does the normal event of my mother's death, which actually is not really terrible. She wasn't murdered. She wasn't attacked. She wasn't lost at sea. Like, she was a little old lady who died in her sleep. Like, it was kind of the best death ever. What I wanted people to see is like, so how did I end up hospitalized from this experience? And a lot of it has to do with the way in which grief landed in my system across my lifespan, and not so much exactly what happened in that moment, which, you know, was I can look at it now and say, like, that's how I would want everyone I love to die. Asleep in their bed. You know, my mother was holding the rosary when she died. Like, she was in her favorite pajamas. She had just seen most of her family members. Like, in a lot of ways, it was super beautiful. I can see that now because my trauma is stabilized. But at the time, it was just untenable.
So how is it like for you, you know, sort of, you know, getting to that point? Because in the book, it's interesting. You talk about your, you know, the childhood and then the big trauma in the summer and your experience, like everybody. I think that's so relatable too. Like, whether it's, you know, a big trauma or just that family, like, creating that slamming you down, you know, and then you kind of dealing with life from then on in that way. And, you know, I think there's a lot of lessons for people reading your book to prepare to kind of be a little bit unhinged. I'm reading this book and I'm walking around, I'm like, oh my gosh. Like, right? What's going on? I'm like, I'm reading Megan's book. and you know, I'm stable, you know, I think, but I think it, you know, and it made me want to ask that question of, like, we all have been through stuff, and then, you know, it kind of shapes our life. So how did you get to the point where, you know, you're to the point where you are now, you know, on the other side of it, but kind of looking back and seeing all of these, like, points that have sort of shaped you? Because in the moment, like you said, you froze being a little kid in that moment, and then, you know, being informed of how to behave by the grown-ups around you and kind of just moving forward. And then the horrible thing at school, your friend being mean to you, like all of these just, you know, nasty stuff. So relatable though.
But it's relatable also because some of it is so normal. So I do think that there are, inside every family, there are things that are expanded, right? Like, we love you for being athletic. We love you for being smart. We love you for being thoughtful. And then there are things that are sort of tampered down and restricted. Mm-hmm. And I think, don't be noisy, don't be proud, whatever it is that become kind of like the country club code of your family, right? Like, what are the rules on the wall about how you're supposed to be? Mm-hmm. Some of those, I think there's, it's so that the system can function. Mm-hmm. So I had 5 brothers and sisters. My dad was away most of the time. My parents had grown up in really complicated families of their own. So one of the things that I'm always aware of as a parent, like, I have 3 kids. People say to me, like, oh, you're a great parent. I'm like, yeah, but I'm sure I'm screwing my kids up too. Like, I'm saving college money. I'm saving therapy money, which is not to say that my kids don't do therapy now, because they have. But I think what is the biggest lesson, and this has really only been formulating for me recently, because I was listening to a podcast where they were really obsessed with the word resilient, and it was pissing me off. They were like talking to this one person who had been inside a system where, like, everybody else had kind of like fallen to drug abuse or to incarceration or health issues. And so they were talking to this one person who, you know, is a professional athlete, and was like, how did you manage to survive? And I understand the instinct of wanting to talk to the winner. But in my mind, I'm like, so what were, how are we not serving all the people who ended up, like, kind of holding that energy inside them, and it was too much to bear. And so they didn't continue to live. They weren't able to overcome. And because I think we talk to people who have overcome situations as though they have an answer, right? And nobody has an answer. You have to find your own way forward. So if we have one person who did fine, like, if you had one kid in a classroom who was reading and 4 who weren't, I don't think sitting and saying to the kid, like, so how are you able to be so successful as a reader, is a great use of time. I think we would do better to look at the 4 and say, show me what you're struggling with. What are you finding hard? Are you having a hard time picking a book? Are you having a hard time blending consonants? So I think when I look back across the trajectory of the story that I understand to have happened in my life, I have a lot of compassion for the ways in which I could not be served, right? Like, it's like walking into a store and wanting a pair of jeans, and they don't sell jeans in that store. Like, you are not going to be served here. And I don't have any blame for my family or myself. What I do look at is, with a lot of gratitude, somehow I believed it was okay to go and get help. Somehow, despite the fact that that was not really modeled for me. And really, I think it was out of desperation. I turned a hard left and went to therapy, which was not something that was normal in the world that I came from. And there just happened to, it was like, I was, you know, really thirsty, and there just happened to be incredibly, you know, cold water there. I mean, the first therapist I had, she just really believed that things were going to be okay for me. And I had never believed that. So having someone, like, think I was funny and think I was smart and think all the things that were hard for me to do on my own, became kind of just sort of like the platform of, like, okay, I'm going to dive off this platform and see what I can find.
Yeah. That's so nice. It makes a lot of sense. And your high school story, when you wrote that essay, or, you know, whatever it was, about your funeral and then you getting elevated and then you kind of pushing yourself down. And that's so heartbreaking, you know, that self-sabotage. And then, you know, it's cool listening to your book, reading your book, because you do make it through the other side. But I really love what you said about, you know, there's no, like, I'm at the top of the mountain, I'm the winner. It's, you know, really guiding guiding us through to how the heck do we sort of get there, I think is the biggest thing.
Yeah. You know, one of the things about going to Exeter, so Exeter for people who are listening, Tara's husband and I went there, is just an incredibly extraordinary opportunity as a teenager. But in order to rise to that opportunity, you have to be willing to work really hard. Mm-hmm. And that requires some belief in yourself. Mm. So when I got to Exeter, I didn't expect to be at the top of the heap in any way, shape, or form. That was not what they said when they admitted me they expected of me. It's not what my family expected of me. And it was definitely not something that I was looking for. I was looking to be kind of like as normal as possible. Where, you know, I would always look at the girls and be like, where did they get those shirts? It was the time, it was that time when like everybody was wearing J. Crew shirts that were like, had horizontal stripes. Like try being a size 12 and wearing a horizontal stripe rugby shirt in high school. It's not good. What happened when I got there was that I was not prepared for. I had been told I had two brothers that went there. And I think their experience was real to them, but it was very like, there's a lot of competition. You have to push yourself forward. You have to accept that you're not going to be the best. And, you know, just keep kind of racing to do as well as you can. And that wasn't my experience. My experience was there are so many interesting people here. There is so much to learn. There are so many classes. And, you know, my grades were not amazing. They weren't terrible. But I really found community of people who thought differently than I did. And I feel like I'm still very close to the women who are in my dorm. And I feel like they raised me. Right? Like they raised me, they challenged me, they asked me about, you know, they taught me what friendship looks like. I didn't really understand that before. It was a very different experience. I was not ready at age 14 for the chair of the English department to say, we see something in you and we would like to pull you out from this. Finally, you feel normal and you're just in the middle of a sea of people. We're going to pull you out and we are going to cultivate this thing that you didn't even identify for yourself that you wanted. Because I had other stuff that I did. Like I loved singing. I had been a singer and I was really happy to stand on a stage and sing. I didn't mind that attention. I'd been looking for that attention since I was like 10.
Wow.
But this, like, we think you can write, we think you're a storyteller was really new. And it freaked me the hell out. And as I say in the book, the exposure was really broad, really fast. Like I didn't know. I'm not that I knew anybody, but people, and it didn't end there. Like that paper that I did was handed out by freshman teachers about that assignment, which is a typical assignment for years. I saw it for years after.
Oh my gosh.
I know. And actually the chair of the department whose name was Terry at the time, I can't remember if I put this in the book, like it got back to him that it had freaked me out.
Wow.
And he took me to like the little coffee shop, Cecilia's, and apologized.
Wow.
And said that it hadn't occurred to him that, you know, which again says something about our high school. It hadn't occurred to him that I wouldn't want the accolade or that that would be more than I could handle.
Oh yeah.
That's or that he should have asked me or talked to me first or any of that about sharing this personal writing that I had done.
Wow. That's amazing. I love that you, and I wanted to ask you also, because there's just so much there. It seems like, okay, Mike and Alex are like good friends. Like, it seems like Alex similar with you, but Alex did not want to be at boarding school. He felt too young to be there and he wanted his family. And he also didn't have like a good, like a happy family, but he still wanted a family. And Mike was the opposite. He was like, get me the heck away from my situation. Yes. And he, like for him, I think Exeter was like the time of his entire life.
Oh my God. Well, he also, I mean, Mike also, and Alex, I mean, they were really high achievers and very well respected across all kinds, you know, sports and academics. And so I can see that, right? I can see that that would have felt amazing. But you know, it's interesting because Exeter's and boarding school is not for everyone. Mm-hmm. And I have a 16-year-old and a 14-year-old and a 12-year-old. But the conversation always comes like, are you going to send your kids to boarding school? Are you going to? I don't think I knew that I needed boarding school. Mm. I don't think that I knew that my family life didn't fit me very well. Mm. You know, I grew up pretty isolated in a small town that, you know, I went to a private school where I didn't really fit in. I don't think I knew it. I can think of lots of experiences in my life where I was like, oh my God, I didn't even know this existed. Mm. So when I got there and felt like, oh, you can just be inside a sea of all kinds of interesting people and you can just float here. Yeah. I don't think I understood what a relief that was going to feel like. So my experience about Exeter is that I loved it. Mm. And I found it really hard. And I think it taught me, I mean, I almost failed math my entire freshman year. And my dorm head was a math teacher. And I called my brother who was at UPenn and I was like, I'm going to fail math. And he was like, you are not going to fail math because that's not an option.
Oh, no.
You have to work until you understand it. And I was like, what if I can't understand it? He was like, that's not an option. So I sat on the floor of my dorm head's, you know, office every single night and was like, did I get this math problem right? I mean, God love that man. He's since died of cancer, but I was 14 years old and was working harder than I ever even understood was possible. Sort of like you teach a kid how to ski where you're like, look what they're doing. But they don't know it's nuts when they're doing it. They don't know that being 5 years old and coming down a black diamond is nuts. They're like, this is what they told me to do. So I feel like I became something else, became a different version of myself amongst the people who taught me what was possible.
Wow.
And I did watch some people I love get eaten up and spit out and ground into something not great by the experience of not having it.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Enough adult supervision and not finding being in the middle and in the sea good. Like I would say with Mike and Alex, I mean, I think they were both the top of her class. So they had different experience than me in terms of like, I didn't want to be at the top of the things. Mm-hmm. I was so relieved to be just in the things.
Yeah.
But I did see some people that's what they wanted. And, and that boarding school is filled with really extraordinarily talented, brilliant, brilliant people. And so it's, you know, it's a hard place to go when you're like 14, 15 years old.
Gosh, so intense. So intense. Oh my gosh. Yeah. So I can't even imagine. I love whenever Mike doesn't talk much about it, but whenever I am around Alex, he'll share more. So I'm happy to hear from you because it's such a unique thing. And, you know, obviously it's brought out so much awesomeness in you. And even though like, you know, obviously like you weren't ready for that, you know, big English experience, but here you are now, you know, sharing in all these beautiful ways. And it's really neat to hear that experience. But can you walk us through this, the part of the book that's like, oh my gosh, you know, so vulnerable for sharing, but like walking yourself into the facility and that person looking up on whether it was the files or the computer, I don't remember. And like all those people that you had like on the other side of your therapy chair. And, you know, what was that like? And also you were grown up then. You had your children then, right? And just, can you just explain that? Because I think that's so cool. There's so many people in our community that, you know, we're further along in life and are now, you know, I think it gives permission to ask for help in lots of different ways for, you know, being in different life stages, because I feel like myself included and other friends, they're like, well, I have my job, I have my life. I can't pause and take care of myself. So I think you did that and it's really cool.
Yeah. You know, so thank you for that. So I start the book with this scene because it has what I think of now to date. So I'm turning 50 this year. It's the proudest thing I am of in my entire life. Which maybe is a weird thing to say, like, oh, I checked myself into an inpatient trauma facility. And it's the thing I'm the most proud of, but it really is because, and I talk about this a lot, like I had sent lots of clients to this facility, which by the way, I had already been to. So I had been to the campus in Tennessee several times as a clinician to take a Brené Brown class. I knew the director of the program. I had gone to dinners with staff. So that's a pretty privileged spot to be in, right? Like, you know, imagine if you have to check yourself into a hospital and you like know the administrator of the hospital. Right. It's a different place. But even saying that, I threw up on the plane going there. I was shaking so much in the car, the car service that took me there, that the driver actually made a phone call to let them know that, like, I might need something when I get
coming
there.
Coming in hot,
exactly. I had, as I often do, like my actual in the moment experience and then this meta experience. And the meta experience was like, this is what it felt like for all those people.
Wow.
Right. So I use this example a lot. Like, you can study France all you want. You can know the topography of the land. You can understand the language. But you don't really understand what it's like to have a hot baguette with fresh salted butter in France until you're there. Mm-hmm. And that is what that scene is for me, is like, oh my God, this is how terrifying. This is how desperate. So, and you know, people do say to me, like, in different ways, like, it's so great that you could do this. And I get this. I get that sentence because it is true. I could do it. Nobody was going to die if I stepped away. You know, I have a husband, so it wasn't like my children were going to be taken into foster care if I stepped away from them. It was not going to financially devastate us, although we could not afford it. So my husband had to borrow money in order for me to go. So I get when people say, like, that's good for you, but I wouldn't have been able to do that. There's like an edge of sort of judgment in that.
Yeah.
The same way that I a little bit feel jealous when people are like, I woke up and I could just like look at my kids and be like, my kids needed me. And I just like functioned for my kids. Like I couldn't do that. So what I sort of feel like was that happened to be a very soft landing that I was lucky to get because I could figure out how to afford it. It wasn't going to get my kids sent to foster care. And I knew it existed. So many people don't know that there are trauma facilities and there aren't that many. So I actually already in my head was like, oh, I know where I need to go. And then I had colleagues who just facilitated the whole thing because when you're really overwhelmed, like even just washing your hands is hard. The idea of like filling out a 42-page intake is not, you know, like, I don't know who filled out that intake, but I promise you it wasn't me. I think it was my sister-in-law.
Wow.
So it was terrifying to leave my kids. The thing that I think was the most terrifying was like the exposure in my marriage. I had always been a really high functioning, like ambitious, energetic, helping kind of person. And, you know, by the time it's in the book, by the time I'm checking myself into the facility, like I physically am not even able to walk. And I just thought multiple times over, this was not the only vulnerable experience I'd had with my husband by any stretch. But I just thought, like, can someone want you after you're this broken? Like, when you can no longer keep up any sort of a facade, aren't you only going to be disgusting? And then I couldn't worry about it because I couldn't do anything about it. So I think sometimes when people say to me like, oh, that was a good choice for you, I get why they're saying that, because it was a choice. Mm-hmm. At the time, it didn't feel like a choice. Mm-hmm. It felt like, if I don't do this, I'm going to die. If I don't do this, I am going to lose everything. And mm-hmm. I'm going to take people down with me.
Yeah. I didn't read that as a, obviously you just laid out privilege really well, but like, yeah. It seemed like that was, you know, the thing to do. And, I saw it as more permission to take care, permission to do me reading this book. Okay, Tara, like, you got to take care of yourself, whatever you can do right now, and sharing your book. It's what we all can do. I mean, maybe this is also your next book as well, but I mean, this is why I lead yoga and things, but often we get emails, you know, and Mike has a little bit more, you know, education and, you know, medical training than I do. So I often like, I pass it up, but it's like, if someone's going to email me about, you know, thoughts of harming themselves or their family, that's out of my role for sure.
You're not really the person for that.
No, I can get you through a nice wrong yoga email class. I can help you connect with your feelings, but you know, maybe this is the next book you're writing, but what are some things people can do, you know, just in your life right now, besides the, you know, the mindfulness practice and things, but if you're sort of at that next level, somebody that is, you know, sort of unsafe for yourself in your life, what can folks do?
Well, I love the way you pose that question. And one of the things that's the most heartbreaking for me and my colleagues in the grief field is that when people come and they say like, okay, I get it. I need much more support than I'm currently getting. Like, I need more therapy than this. Mm. What should I do? We have a really hard time answering that question because there's not, there's either kind of like weekly therapy or intensive inpatient. And then there are daily practices, but you know, I've been a person with lots of daily practices my entire life. Mm. And those daily practices did not stave off the traumatization of my mom's sudden death. Mm. So I think, and it goes back to a question that you asked before, I think believing that it is okay to ask for help and to ask for help repeatedly and to even ask people to help you find help is, like a human quality that we need to believe in, and that being a person who believes that people deserve help and that you don't need to know immediately the help to give someone, that you can also, you know, if we can make it into a net and a network, you know, lots of times people will say, my daughter's in Ohio. She just went there for college. Do you know any practitioners out there? Mm. I don't, but I know some listservs where I can ask other people who may know some practitioners out there. So I think the larger piece is like believing that we are not failing when we need help, that we are entitled to help, and that help can come in form, that help is the whole sentence. You don't have to say, I need you to help me by X, Y, and Z, that help is the whole sentence, and that asking then allows the people to bring you what they believe in and what they have. And then you can pick and choose. You don't have to, you know, if they said, well, I think you should you should join this cult. Like, you don't have to pick that. You can pick, you can pick something else. But I do think, and this is, I'm writing a clinical book right now. The clinical book really is about how do you grow into a supportive practice for yourself?
I love that.
I think, right. And I use the language supportive practice and, you know, I have a whole method. It's called the mentor method that just, it grounds in mindfulness and looking at your energy and making sure you're nourished and making sure that you're translating and talking. And, you know, so it sort of walks you through what do we know are the good things and, you know, energetically to support a human in their life. Mm-hmm. But I think the phrase self-care has taken on, particularly for women, this idea that if you were doing self-care well enough, you would never fall down. That everything would just sort of like stay neutral. And that's not what self-care is. Self-care is this flexible, versatile way of showing up for yourself when you need more in your life of whatever, and then having some idea of what that might be, right? Like we were talking in the beginning about how like yoga is not it for everybody and there's wisdom in that and that's fine. But if it's not yoga, do you know what it is? And if you don't know what it is, are you actively seeking what would work for you? Because what happens for grievers is, and this is how I ended up writing, is like you are no longer who you used to be. That's how fundamental loss is it changes your identity. And so it's not that nothing is, it remains unbroken. It's hard to figure out what isn't broken. Like, right? Like if there's a hurricane in your house, like everything looks broken. When you pull things apart, you're going to see like, oh no, this picture frame is intact, but it takes a minute. And one of the things that we talk about in terms of trauma is like a bad thing happens. You have to sit in that space and sort of process that bad thing through you. If you get up and you only feel the worse for the bad thing, we know that there's trauma inside your system. You've been traumatized, right? Which is what happened when my mom died. I walked through and I couldn't figure out who I was or what, you know, what I was even doing with my life. For some people that just integrates a little bit over time. My experience with that is that my symptoms got worse and worse and worse. I was getting more and more afraid and feeling more and more physically terrible in my body. So the bad thing happens, we kind of get up, and the thing is, we do have to be able to live forward. Like you don't just, the tree falls over the path that you were on. That's awful. But you can't stand there going, oh my God, this tree forever.
Right.
Right. You got to figure out a way over it. And once you are over it or through it, around it, you are going to mourn the path that you thought you were on forever. But what do I need on the path that I'm on now? And so a lot of what I do with my grievers is say, is there anything that you have been thinking about or noticing is kind of like attractive or drawing you to it in a surprising way? Anything? And if they say yes, I say, what is it? And sometimes they're like, you know, I played the violin in high school and it's under the bed and I keep thinking I should play the violin. And I don't go into a long lecture about how like music actually takes us to a different energetic plane and that is a way of moving energy through the body. Or if somebody says to me, it's weird, I really want to be outdoors, I also don't say like grounding and being out in energy is good for your dopamine levels. I just say, go do it. Go do it. If you have an instinct, go do it. And then come back and tell me how it went.
No.
Did it meet your expectations? Were there surprises when you were there? There are a bunch of people where they have no idea. And I have no idea. I want to be able to do something, but I have no idea. And for those people, I have this giant whiteboard that looks like a menu in my office. It's like those word searches that people are putting out for the beginning.
Cool.
Yeah, I did one of those the other day and the word I found was celery, by the way. I was like, oh, I'm manifesting. Okay. So on that list is everything anyone has ever told me helps them in grief. And it's everything from drinking, that's on there, like having promiscuous sex. Those things are on there. People have told me that those are helpful. I don't think they're helpful over a long period of time, but they are probably helpful for a little bit of time. And also gardening and sculpting and drawing, you know, all the ing words, all the verbing of grief. But we do have to figure those things out, right? Like we do have to figure out how do we live forward in our lives in general. And I think for me, writing became that tool, that totally surprising tool, but maybe also a little bit like the violin under the under the bed. Like I was kind of always there.
Yeah.
I just didn't need it so much. And now, you know, my trauma with my mom is stabilized. I feel really different 4 years later. 4.5 years later, but I still write. I write every day because it came to me out of a terrible place. Writing came to help me and support me when I was really struggling, but it turns out to be a part of who I am that I'm really happy to be back in communion with.
Well, you're really good at it. So I'm glad you're doing it. We all love reading it.
That is so kind of you.
Of course. You're amazing. You're super talented. Thanks for all the free therapy, by the way. And for all the listeners. Oh my gosh. Can you share a little bit about your process, like actually writing the book and working with Zibby and having your, because a lot of folks listening as well are interested in sharing their story and just how you made that happen for yourself.
Yeah, you know, I think one of the things that gets really overwhelming about a story is, like, particularly people who want the traumatic growth. They want the meaning. They want the bad thing that happened to become something better, which is probably all of us. We can very instantly dream of, like, I want this to be a memoir. I want this to be a book. I want it to be made into a movie. Not so much because we're narcissistic, but because that soothes us to believe that, like, I remember when the Queen died, I was watching her funeral and my best friend texted me and was like, can you believe this? And I think she was like this opulence and insanity. And I wrote back to her, like, I would have done this for my mom. Wow. If someone let me, I would have spent this $73 million and stopped all of England to have a service for my mom. And so sometimes when I was writing the book, I'm like, is this just that? Am I just writing this because this is all just like a giant, you know, the Sphinx is really just a memorial to a dead wife. Like, I get that. Mm-hmm. So what I would say to people who are writing is just sit down and write. I know that's infuriating. I know that doesn't feel like good. You know, it's like when people are like, you just need to take a deep breath and drink some water. It's like, yeah, but you really do need to take a deep breath and drink some water. And I think what I would say is I really have lived by the belief that, like, we're all kind of energetically connected to a higher purpose. And you don't have to call that God and you don't have to, but I really think you can feel that when you're grieving. And I really think when you've landed inside your body, you can feel that. And I think if you can't feel it, you can go outside and look at a tree that is growing and be like, I don't think that's random. And, you know, and I have found myself more in need of that. So what I really like to say to people is okay, I'll say this right now. My husband, if he were here, would be like, don't do it. Don't talk about the trees, Megan. Don't do it.
I love it. Are you kidding? And
one of the first experiences I had with Zibby in real life and all of our team, we were going to like a very fancy party. We were all dressed up and we were in a car and somebody said something and I was like, oh yeah, that's just like trees. And then I started talking and then I was like, oh my God, I started saying out loud, my husband told me not to talk about trees. I sound like such a lunatic when I talk about trees. But here's the thing about trees. Trees are connected underneath the ground and they support each other. I mean, some trees actually will move their branches and thin themselves out so other trees can get the light. There are trees in South America that actually get up and walk so that they can move towards, and they will take other trees with them. Trees are, and mycelium, which is the fungus that helps the world regenerate. I mean, it's like, oh, that's God. That's the holy interconnection. So if you have a hard time with anything that I'm talking about that sounds like spirituality, no problem. Just believe in trees. Like, just trees are real. And an arborist will tell you, you cut down one tree, it impacts all the rest of the trees around it for like 30 years. So I think writing is like that. I think that when I am reading The Fifth Chamber by Anne Gruber, which I'm reading right now, which gives me chills just talking about it, she wrote to me and said, your writing reminds me of mine. And then I started reading it and I was like, how can she say that? This is the most beautiful writing in the world. Like, that is such a compliment to me. And then I got to a line and I was like, I could have written that line. He wrote a line that I could have written. And there's this crazy story about Anne Gilbert and Anne Patchett. They both had the same idea for a book, State of Wonder. And Anne Patchett wrote it. And Elizabeth Gilbert, not Anne Gilbert. I think we are rooted by the human experience in words. And so when people are like, I don't know if my story matters, what I say is your story is part of everyone's story. That your roots are going to entangle with other people's. You don't have to be the best writer. You don't actually even have to publish it. But being able to create it, create an understanding of what happened to you that makes sense to you. And then maybe being willing, that's enough. You don't have to share it with anyone, but there is a real gift to you as the writer and to the other people around you. Because they may not understand some of the most beautiful feedback that I've gotten, you know, from like Amazon reviews, or people are like, Megan's story is nothing like my story, but I got so much out of it. Mm. And I understand that because we are, you know, feelings are human mm. and they're what connect us. So when people are wondering about that, what I would say is just write and see where that writing takes you. Not everybody has to make a memoir. And when you are in purpose and the next, you know, kind of doing the next right thing, I do think sometimes doors open. I think my story with Zibby Owens is a hard pill to swallow for a lot of people because it does, even to me, it feels like, oh, and then the fairy godmother came while I was sleeping and said, here, my child, you can have a, you know, a book contract. So I think for some people to hear, like, I was just writing on a blog and I was writing for my own process. And then I went to Zibby's book club and, you know, she started to read my writing and then she offered me a book contract is a really frustrating thing because they've been pitching their writing and they've been trying to get an agent and I get that because in other parts of my life, I am that. I'm like, I am, you know, cracking my head up against the wall. How come, you know, I'm not getting this opportunity and someone else did so easily. But I do think there are people out there that are going to find places to magnify what their experience is because that is where it's supposed to be magnified. Mm. And then maybe for other people, just the writing will be, they will come to understand themselves better and that will make them a different partner in listening to other people's stories and holding space for other people. When they grieve, I've been having these really interesting conversations with people who I've known in their grief who are now supporting their partner mm. in grief.
Wow.
And sort of like, what is that like? You know, I think you would inherently think, oh, well, they must be really great mm. at supporting their partner. And that does not always bear out to be true. but it's interesting. So I'm always encouraging of people who are writers. I'll say this to your group that I'm about to start a new process to product class, which is we write for the process of coming to understand your narrative. We work on one chapter and then we polish it so that you can pitch it to, you know, we make it 1500 words at the most, so that you can pitch it to, you know, a magazine or the New York Times or something. And it's an 8-week class. And if people are interested in that, they could come to my website. And I'm actually doing one as a corporate thing. There's a company that has hired me because they have writers and they want to do it, which I think will be really fun. I've never done that. I've only ever done it with writers before, but I'm kind of open-minded to, you know, trying everything with everybody.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, I love that you brought up the trees because, like, I'm the tree nerd too.
I'm obsessed with trees. I'm obsessed with them.
It's the whole thing, and you can explain anything by explaining trees. It just makes it all easy, and that's how I met you. I mean, I met me randomly on Instagram. I mean, I've written a lot of books that are health and wellness and stuff like that, very different than the Zibby world. And Zibby interviewed me during the pandemic for this yoga book that I did for kids. And I'm like, who is this woman and why is she interviewing people on Instagram? And then I stayed on and she interviewed all these, like, back to back, all these incredible people just like you. And then I started reading books that I would have never read before.
Exactly.
At all.
Exactly.
I'm not even interested in. And
that's
then
right.
So I meet her and I go to her house and she's like, Tara, I just want to help people read more. And I'm like, I just want to help people do yoga more. And it was like the trees, you know? And then so hanging around her and then getting to meet you. And this is about, like, this book, I might've found it at a bookstore and I wouldn't have met you. And I would have known that you were in class with Mike and Alex at all. Right. And then here we are. And then your book being about grief and trauma, which is so central to what so many people in our community are going through, including myself, but, you know, all of us at the same time. So, like, the trees are real, dude.
I mean, they are. If anyone really wants to, like, dig deep, the first 45 minutes of the documentary Fantastic Fungi will, like, blow your mind. That one's mostly about mushrooms, but it's all the same. But I love how you just sort of outlined, because I do think Zibby, I think there are some people, like, I have some people in my life who the first time I met them, I was like, oh, wait a second. I could just feel the energy. I've worked with Glennon Doyle and been friends with Glennon for a long time. And the first time I met her, I was like, wait a second. You know, it was way before she was a thing. And I think there are some people where you come into their energy, and again, just bearing with this, it feels like a purpose. It feels like holy. It feels like it's about something bigger than just whatever they're doing in this moment. And I think, you know, I think Zibby understands the power of a story, right? Like there's a Cecil Day Lewis quote that we write so that we can feel understood. I just butchered it. It's something way more articulate than that. And I think we read for that purpose as well, which is like, you know, it's hard to get deep down in a conversation with someone quickly. Although I will say I really only have people around me who are able to do that, who are able to kind of like get into a real human conversation quickly. But even in novels, humans are showing you who they are and what they care about. And I've said so many times that I think we're all only ever having one conversation, right? With, you know, I think that we are all only ever having one conversation. And I think grief is a big part of that conversation that gets excluded and not named. Mm. And I think in the Western culture, at least, because other cultures do much better at this, you know, we have defined it as some kind of failing instead of as just a totally normal part of the process of living. Mm. And so we alienate and exclude, and actually it's the most inclusive. We will all grieve. Every single human will grieve. It is the most inclusive. And so when I stand on my soapbox and do my clinical work and work in corporations, and you know, that is what I'm trying to remind people, is like, it, you don't have to currently be grieving in order to perpetuate a grief-informed culture that is inclusive. And when I think about Zibby, she is the most inclusive. She is a hype girl. She wants people to be connected. She does these retreats that are about that. She has, you know, all these free offerings. And I think she's really come into her purpose. I mean, I've known her. I was like there when it all sort of began. Like my first book contract with her was before she had a publishing company, and it fell through. She was going to do an imprint with another company, and it fell through. And she was like, "You just work on your book." She gave me an editor to work with me. She was like, "You work on your book, and who knows?" She was like laughing, "Who knows? Maybe I'll start a publishing company." And then like a year later, maybe it wasn't even a year later, I can't remember how I learned she was starting a publishing company, but it was like, "Okay, we're going to buy your book and we're going to publish it." And I was like, "What just happened here?" And for me, that was really extraordinary, because I was becoming something in that sort of like traumatic growth way, where like I couldn't stay here. The tree was, you know, over my path. I couldn't keep doing what I was doing. I wasn't sure what I was going to do. And Zibby was like, "Here are some things. Why don't you do these?" And I was like, that's a good enough reason to like get up in the morning. I'll come to your book club. I'll read these books I wouldn't have otherwise read. And it did. I became a writer again. I became part of a community. Her community is such a broad, brought us together. Like it is really extraordinary. And not everybody has to do that. Mm. But I do think we can all join those things.
Yeah.
And be a part of that.
Yeah, it's super cool. Oh my gosh. So end of the hour. What is your new, the clinical book? Is it for everyone? And is the title?
Yes. So End of the Hour is, you know, the memoir, which is my personal experience with grief and loss that I very intentionally put in almost like a wink to most of my clients, all the generalizable experiences with grief and loss that each one of them has. I put a chapter in End of the Hour where I have a huge fight with my husband, because every griever I have ever met has almost gotten divorced at some point because they, you know, hate and despise the people who are the closest to them, because that's how our emotions show up. My clinical book is called Can Anyone Tell Me? It's coming out with Sounds True in October. And it is, so it's, can anyone tell me like why I have brain fog? Can anyone tell me why I can't eat? Can anyone tell me? And I'm the person, and I, you know, there's not like one answer to these questions, but in as simple terms as I can. So each chapter is like 5 pages. I answer the question, why you have brain fog, giving a little bioscience and neuroscience and sort of, and then I explain sort of historically how we treat that, what we do about it. I give a clinical example. Here's a client, here's what their brain fog looked like, here's what we do. And then I give suggestions to grievers if they have brain fog, suggestions to people who are supporting them, So the book is really intended for both populations, and then an exercise, just like one. And you know, the first chapter, the very first exercise really is set a timer so that you're drinking water every 20 minutes because we burn through, you know, our electrolytes are when we're learning something new, which is really what we're doing when we're grieving, we're learning how to live in a world without someone. And it's like somebody stripped away all the signposts. So you don't know what street you're on and you don't know what time it is. Like all the ways that you're normally oriented are gone when someone really profound is gone. It's very energetically expensive to your brain. So drinking water is an actual intervention. And doing a little bit of box breathing to balance your brain is an actual intervention. So I give little interventions and explanations. And my hope is it's going to be used by schools as a curriculum. I mean, it's built so that that would be possible and that people will use it as a reference guide. Like you don't, if you're sleeping fine, you don't need to read that chapter. But if you, you know, can't believe you hate everyone you've ever met, that the chapter that says, can anyone tell me why I hate everyone? That might be your chapter. Or can anyone tell me why, you know, I think this butterfly is my mom? You know, a lot of people have these sudden onset spiritual experiences. So it's 27 chapters. And my hope is people are going to find it really simple and easy to read. But in the meantime, End of the Hour is actually out already. And it is
so good.
It has a lot. Thank you. It has a lot of what becomes the you know, the clinical book is really just the teaching of that. End of the Hour is all my experience with it. All my personal, you know, I did, there was a butterfly. I did kind of think it was my mom. Despite myself, because I didn't love that stuff.
So good. Well, I love it. And I hope it does become a movie. I think it would be a great movie. I mean, especially the scene walking into the clinic. I mean, it's so visual. It's part of your life. So
yeah,
you know, if that's on your dream list, you know, I'm right there ready to watch it too.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you. That is an, well, and what that says to a writer is that people could visualize it. Yeah. You know, when you say this reads like a movie, I think what it means is you could picture it and that means you did something right. It doesn't seem totally. What I'm doing with it right now, what I'm doing with End of the Hour right now is I'm talking at social work schools and at clinical programs and partnering, you know, people who are doing yoga to just sort of like use it as a jumping off point. Because I really do think like, here's a clinician who should have been able to circumnavigate grief because I knew all the things, had studied all the things and know all the treatments for the things, but I didn't. And so what does that mean for the average griever? Like, what does it mean about what grief is and how do we attend to it? And so it really has driven, depending on which audience I have, you know, the depth of conversation is so rewarding to me. Even when people haven't read the book yet, to just be able to talk about, this is what I experienced with grief and loss. You say that out loud and someone else hears it and that normalizes it, right? Like, it's so important.
So cool. Oh, well, you're amazing. Thanks for taking all the
time. You're amazing. Oh my gosh. Thank you so much for having me. This is just a complete delight. And I have an absolute open fantasy that we will collaborate with something.
Yes, please. Yes,
yeah,
please.
We can bring the boys.
Yeah, sounds good.
Mike and Alex can come. I would love to take Tai Chi with Mike. I've done many videos of his, so that would be incredibly amazing. Tell him I said hi. And really, thank you so much for this. This was just a real honor to sit and get and talk to you today.
Of course, you're the best. Thank you. Welcome back. I hope you enjoy that conversation with Megan Rood and Jarvis as much as I did. I was so fired up about it. I had to go for a walk, take a shower, do some practice, eat something nourishing. It just was, oh, so I'm recording this the next day. Coming to you, all the info about her book, The End of the Hour, and her projects, her writing classes are below in the notes. And make sure you are practicing with us on the Strala Yoga app so you can get that daily practice of noticing how you feel, move yourself, move your energy, take really good care of you. And if you need any extra help at all, please reach out. We're here to help and support and take care of you, take care of each other. That's so important. We're all connected. So big hugs. Thanks so much for being here and see you soon.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.